please. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 11-708, Shirley Sherrod versus Andrew Breitbart et al. Appellants. Mr. Brown for Appellant O'Connor. Mr. Levinson Waldman for Amicus Curiae, contributing chief for Appellate.
Good morning. May it please the court. The D.C. Attorney General will take 5 minutes of my time to present argument on the Erie Doctrine. This case reminds people on all sides of the political spectrum how difficult but how important it is to talk about race. Mr. Breitbart and Mr. O'Connor criticized Mrs. Sherrod's statements to an NAACP audience because they believed the statements and the audience's reaction reflected hypocrisy or a double standard in the NAACP accusing the Tea Party of racism. Mrs. Sherrod saw her life story and her attitudes in one light. For her, as for her country, there is much deeply felt history on the subject of race. But Mr. Breitbart and Mr. O'Connor saw her provocative speech about her unwillingness to give her full help to a white person in need in quite a different light. The commentary in their blog post criticizing the NAACP for hosting her speech takes us straight into D.C.'s new anti-SLAPP statute.
Your arguments are all assuming we get to merit sorts of issues. Aren't there a lot of hurdles we need to get over before we get to any merits issues?
Your Honor, there are. And as I was saying, the blog post commentary takes us straight into D.C.'s new anti-SLAPP statute, which protects the right of advocacy on matters of public concern.
You're right about that. This case reminds us of the importance of race, at least for these judges. It reminds me of how complicated federal courts was in law school.
Right. We've had that experience too,
right,
Your Honor, in
preparing
for the case
today.
Help
us with that, too.
And the reason we're here today is because D.C.'s new anti-SLAPP statute explicitly creates immunities for speakers on matters of public concern. When the D.C. Council said that it is following the lead of other jurisdictions which have extended similar absolute and qualified immunities to individuals engaging in protected actions. And it is these immunities we are asking the court to recognize today. And the whole point of immunity is to get here in front of you on interlocutory appeal to protect a defendant from the burdens of discovery and trial.
Don't you have a timeliness problem? You filed your motion too late?
Not at all, Your Honor. We had two explicit extensions of time from Judge Leon.
You filed your motion pursuant to Rule 6B of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, correct?
We had a 12B motion, Your Honor, in addition to our anti-SLAPP motion. We had two separate motions. One was a 12B6, and one was the anti-SLAPP motion.
The only one before us now is the anti-SLAPP motion, right?
That is right.
So, and the motion says that we hereby move the court pursuant to Rule 6B of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you realize 6B doesn't apply to statutory deadlines? You cannot get an extension of time for a statutory deadline under Rule 6B. Only deadlines set by the rules of civil procedure or by the court, but not by statute. And what you have here is a statutory deadline of 45 days.
Your Honor, we incorporated the substantive arguments from our 12B6 motion into our anti-SLAPP motion. And I believe what the law shows is that unless the legislature explicitly stated that a time period for filing is jurisdictional,
no, it's not that a question. You couldn't get an extension of time under Rule 6B, and the only extension of time you sought was under Rule 6B.
But Your
Here's
Honor,
the holding. The holding is from 637 Fed 3rd at 365, decided by this court in 2011. It says, every court to have considered this question has held that Rule 6B may be used only to extend time limits imposed by the court or by the federal rules, but not by statute. So you don't have an extension of time for that 45-day period, and Judge Leon, therefore, it seems to me, was correct in saying that you were out of time.
What I see is we have a court sitting in diversity jurisdiction, and under Erie, it's to apply the substantive law of the jurisdiction. The substantive law here we're asking the court to apply is the new D.C. anti-slap statute.
Which
the 45-day period,
45 days.
The 45-day period is not explicitly constricted in the statute as being jurisdictional by the legislature of...
It doesn't matter whether it's jurisdictional or not. You didn't file within the 45 days, and you didn't get an extension. And unless you have an extension of time, then the district judge was quite correct in saying that your motion was untimely.
Well, we did have two extensions of time from Judge Leon.
They didn't apply to the 45-day period. We just went over that. You filed under Rule 6B, and 6B doesn't extend time for – can extend time for statutory deadlines, whether you call them jurisdictional or not.
Your Honor, my understanding of the law is that unless the legislature explicitly states that a time period for filing is intended to be jurisdictional, that, in fact, the court has the discretion, as this – judge did, to extend it. Now, Judge Leon, in his statement of reasons,
not under Rule 6,
forgot that he had, in fact, given us two explicit extensions. And therefore, his ruling on the timeliness was clearly erroneous because it's based on a false factual predicate.
Do you disagree with the point of Judge Randolph's questions that 6B cannot be used to extend statutory deadlines? That seemed to me the nub of the issue. Is that right or is that wrong?
I think the nub of the issue, Honor, is that in an Erie setting, when the federal court is applying a substantive provision, that if there is some procedural provision in federal court, that the substantive provision under D.C. law is what should apply. And the council was explicit in stating that it was creating substantive protections for speakers on matters of public concern. And therefore, the substantive law of the...
Cut the substance procedure out, because you don't get to that unless your motion was timely. If you had been in superior court and you filed 50 days or 60 days or 70 days after service of process, would it be proper for a superior court judge to reject your motion because it was untimely?
No, it would not be proper, because we are talking about a substantive provision here. I mean, the District of Columbia has...
What does the 45-day period mean, then, to you?
What the 45-day period means is that you file within 45 days of service unless you receive an extension from the district court.
My hypothetical is you're in superior court.
Right, or the trial court.
You don't get an extension, and you file 60 days after service. The district or the superior court judge would find your motion untimely, right?
I think the superior court judge might in that instance, although there have been cases under other slap statutes where courts have recognized the broad remedial purpose of an anti-slap provision and have not applied that kind of provision with that sort of stringency Your Honor is describing. My position is it's a substantive provision. We're not applying federal procedural law here. We're applying the substantive law of the District of Columbia, and the 45-day period in the statute is not defined as jurisdictional.
The substantive law, procedural law, nonetheless, the extension of time that you sought was not under D.C. local law. It was under the federal rules of civil procedure, and they don't apply to statutory deadlines. So,
well, Your Honor, if I could turn for a minute to what three circuit courts around the country have done with the collateral order doctrine in the context of anti-slap statutes. We have the not
assuming, by the way, my question. I'm assuming we have appellate jurisdiction.
Yes.
But if we exercised it, we'd exercise it at least until I hear something from you. Otherwise, we'd exercise it to affirm the untimeliness ruling of the district court.
What three appellate courts around the country have said is that there is collateral order jurisdiction for the federal appellate courts when state law has created, as D.C. has, immunity for speakers on matters of public concern. Here, the district has created these immunities explicitly. It's in the legislative history. It's in the entire structure of the statute, the way the provisions are set up to expedite the handling of an unmeritorious libel action.
You say that D.C. has created immunity, but it's not in the statute, is it? I mean,
Your Honor,
one of the things that courts have looked at is whether or not there is in the statute a right to immediate appeal.
Your Honor, in the cases that I've cited from the other circuits, none of those states explicitly said in their statute that they were creating an immunity. The Ninth Circuit does have a California SLAPP statute that provides for interlocutory appeal. The First and the Fifth were looking at state statutes that did not. But like the district, it was evident from the legislative intent that the there was a desire to create an immunity. The Fifth Circuit case, I think, is the one that's on all fours with us, because there, the state of Louisiana had not created an explicit interlocutory appeal provision, but the Fifth Circuit, Judge Prado, looking at the intent of the legislature and looking at the broad and important purpose behind protecting speakers on matters of public concern from the burdens of trial, found that the legislative intent was the guide, and the guide took them to creating collateral order jurisdiction in the Fifth Circuit. Here, we have the district explicitly stating in its legislative report to the council that it was following the lead of other jurisdictions. When the district enacted this law, we had Batsell in California, we had Henry in the Fifth Circuit, and then very importantly, we had the McNair Builders case in the D.C. Court of Appeals, which had been decided by the point the council enacted this legislation. And in the McNair Builders case, you see the D.C. Court of Appeals embrace Henry and embrace the notion that under the collateral order doctrine, because importance, we know from recent Supreme Court jurisprudence, has taken on a greater meaning in collateral order cases, that Henry reflected that when you look on the continuum of importance, that there is no interest as important as protecting speakers with immunity provisions from the burdens of trial and discovery. And therefore, you have the D.C. Council knowing the McNair Builders had been decided. So when it says it's looking to other jurisdictions and other guidance on the creation of immunities, you see that that's the precedent there. And when you get to collateral order, Your Honors, I think you'll find that applying the collateral order doctrine to these speaker immunity cases fits very comfortably within your Section 1983 jurisprudence, because what you'll be looking for is a pure question of law that is separate from the merits, that is conclusive, and that's unreviewable. And this court has come up with a very pithy articulation of that standard when it said that the precedent looks at, I can't, as a matter of law, have done this. Those sort of cases are immediately appealable versus I didn't, as a matter of fact, do this, which are cases which are fact-bound, which have not been taken up on collateral appeal. When you look at the intent of the district, when you, as my colleague will discuss under the Erie Doctrine, recognize that there is a substantive procedure here that is to be applied in federal court under the Erie Doctrine, and when you recognize that this statute was meant to have application to pending cases, because in the fiscal impact statement, Mr. Gandhi explicitly said it would apply to current as well as potential SLAPP defendants, that language was expressly incorporated into the statute, and therefore we have explicit guidance from the D.C. Council that the statute was, one, intended to create an immunity, two, it was intended to apply in federal court under the Erie Doctrine, and three, that it would apply to pending and current libel defendants like Mr. O'Connor. And I'm saving the rest of
my... Can I go back to the timeliness question? When did the clock start running, the 45-day clock? What's your view about when it...
The clock started running when she served her complaint on February 12, 2011.
But that was before the effective date.
Yeah, well, don't you want to be arguing something a little different than that? You want to try that one again, maybe?
Your Honors, the law had been signed. It was on its way to Congress for its review period. And because of Mr. Gandhi's statement that's been incorporated into the statute through the fiscal impact statement, it was obvious that when the statute became effective March 31, that anyone who filed a SLAPP motion after that date would then be within all fours
After that date, but there's no argument that the clock doesn't begin to run until the SLAPP Act becomes effective?
No, I think the 45-day period would begin to run when she served her complaint, Your Honor. And that was on March, and that was on February 12th.
And it expired on March 30th.
Well, we had two explicit extensions from Judge.
If you hadn't gotten
extensions. But obviously, if the clock runs when the act becomes effective, you're well within the time period regardless of.
Your Honor, yes.
But you don't agree with that. That's not a viable reading of.
No.
Okay.
And I've got 30 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Brown. I want to pick up where Judge Randolph was earlier in the questioning in this sense. The court does not get to the Erie question until the court finds that there is Cohen appellate jurisdiction and if the court overcomes the retroactivity and the timeliness issues. But if the court gets to the Erie question, then it's important to understand the nature of the protections provided by this statute. The district's anti-SLAPP law provides a qualified immunity to those who speak out on a matter of public interest and are subjected as a result to a meritless lawsuit and the accompanying costs and distress. The statute, passed by this jurisdiction's state-level legislature to protect speech rights, applies in federal diversity cases under the Erie Doctrine's two-part test because, one, it does not conflict with the federal rules, and two, Erie's policy of equitable administration of laws and stopping forum shopping decisively support the statute's application in diversity cases. First, there is no conflict with the federal rules here because the federal rules do not answer the key operative question whether, under Section 5502 of the B of the Act, immunity from suit is proper and is established. And that it is immunity that, if it is established, confers. If it is established and is it shown that the claim arises out of an act that is in furtherance of the right of advocacy on issues of public interest and the plaintiff cannot show a likelihood of success on the merits, if that standard of immunity is satisfied, the statute then confers on the defendant the right to immediate dismissal and the opportunity to seek costs and fees in furtherance of the purposes of the statute. The act thus provides a mechanism for a defendant to seek an early victory in litigation that is importantly different than the bases in Rule 12 or Rule 56. And so it can, as a practical matter, operate in tandem with those rules. There's no conflict here, nothing that would require a trial court sitting in this building to have to pick between one of two opposing or conflicting directives. And that's the standard the Supreme Court has set in the Erie cases culminating in Shady Grove, and as recognized just last year by this court in Burke applying Shady Grove. The fact that the federal rule and the state rule both touch on a topic involving procedure does not answer the question for you. The issue is whether the federal rule occupies the field and crowds out application of these state-level protections. And so this court, in its answering service decision, applied the District of Columbia law that required separation between cross claims and a new claim, notwithstanding the fact that the federal rules describe the claims, cross-claims and counterclaims that must be joined to an original claim. There was no conflict, and the state-level law applies.
There's another way you get there, isn't there? And that is to say that Rule 12 and Rule 56 are actually not consistent with the SLAPP Act, but the SLAPP Act is actually giving something akin to immunity, so we use that here. Isn't that a different way? That's a different way to get there. That's obviously not the way you're choosing to get there.
I think that is a different way of making the same point, which is that what this statute is doing is asking the question, has an immunity been established? And if so,
right.
Mandate.
No, I'm just suggesting that there can be conflict with Rule 12 and Rule 56 here, and I think there probably is. I mean, you're talking about a different procedural scheme that has very different consequences for a plaintiff. As a plaintiff, you'd much rather be under Rule 12 and Rule 56 than under the Anti-SLAPP Act, right?
I would agree entirely, Your Honor, yeah. That they are different standards being applied. There's a different test. That does not constitute conflict. And the reason is what the...
Well, I'm saying even if it is conflict, you don't lose your Erie argument, do you? I mean...
No, I agree with that as well, but you don't even get into the conflict.
This is issue spotting for our federal courts exam. That's what we're doing.
We are rich with issues to spot.
Did the defendants move, when they filed their SLAPP Act motion, Did they frame it up as a 12B6 motion? Failure to state a cause of action?
My understanding of the record is that the defendants filed separate motions, one under 12B6 of the federal rules, and a second under the Anti-SLAPP
not
Act.
Relying, the 12B6 district. Motion did not rely on the District of Columbia law?
The 12B6 motion did not rely on the District of Columbia anti-SLAPP law. It did address common law substantive District of Columbia.
Yeah, because
I think to your question, Judge Randolph, perhaps what you're getting at is the anti-SLAPP motion, as I understand the record, laid out the reasons why the statute applied. And then when it got to the likelihood of success on the merits prong, I understand that the defendants incorporated by reference the same defamation defenses that they had made in the 12B6.
Well, there would be, if they had framed it up as a 12B6 motion, relying on the District of Columbia SLAPP, anti-SLAPP, then there would be a conflict with the federal rules, because in order to decide that motion, the court would have to go beyond the pleadings.
I agree entirely with that.
And if it went beyond the pleadings, the federal rules require, says must, the court must follow Rule 56 for summary judgment, which the SLAPP, anti-SLAPP statute does not allow.
It's important that what the SLAPP Act was doing here was quite separate and distinct from the relief being sought by the defendants. And so you have examples from a number of jurisdictions, both in this circuit and elsewhere, where courts have evaluated separately, in the same case, but evaluated separately and under different standards, and often with different results, a defendant's motion on the one hand under the federal rules, and a defendant's motion on the other hand applying a different set of standards under the state anti-SLAPP. Indeed, you have some cases where circuit courts have been asked to evaluate the grant of one and the denial of another, simply because the standards are different, and that's appropriate.
Some of the Court of Appeals cases that I've read talk about the a right to avoid trial, but these statutes are really not so much about avoiding trial. What they're really about is avoiding the enormity of discovery that takes place in defamation suits against the press, for example. There's a Supreme Court case called Herbert versus Landau, where one deposition lasted more than a year and took up 24 volumes. And that's the kind of thing that this statute is aimed, it seems to me, is aimed at avoiding, which is one of the reasons why the motion has to come in right at the beginning of the lawsuit within 45 days of service.
Judge Randolph, I think that's dead right. The legislative history in the District of Columbia Act, and indeed underlying the anti-SLAPP acts in California and the other jurisdictions that the district was modeling its law on, pointed to a rich body of evidence assembled over the last 30 years that showed major costs to defendants in the media context, but also of great importance in the context of just public citizens, people speaking out, for example, against a developer in their neighborhood. And so the council, for example, relied particularly on testimony by the ACLU and others about cases where individual citizens had been hit with a meritless lawsuit, had to endure a great discovery cost, time, distress, etc. Well,
the statute is limited to what evolved after New York Times versus Sullivan, where it started out only public officials get the protection of the malice standard that Justice Brennan laid down. But then it moved to individuals that were in the public eye, and then it moved to issues of public concern. So all this statute aims only at cases in which the New York Times versus Sullivan malice standard would apply, and it's because of that standard that plaintiffs have this huge opportunity to get into the editorial judgments that are being made by the newspapers and by the media and by whatever, you know.
I agree with a caveat, which is I think that the statute may extend to provide protections broader than just in the New York Times context. The statute is quite broad, so on its face, it provides a defense for claims that arise out of an act in furtherance of the right of advocacy on issues of public interest, and that could be a wide range of statements giving rise to a wide range of torts, including defamation and libel, but also some of the commercial torts that we've seen around the country.
Thank you.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, I'm happy to save any time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Thomas Iannucci representing the appellee Shirley Sherrod. Your Honors, I would like to go to this issue of collateral order doctrine. And as you pointed out, Judge Randolph, it is the case that in certain limited categories of cases, there may be a status that provides immunity, as you talked about in the Durenberger case, and you distinguish it whether you are or not, or as this court, I think all three of you were on the case involving whether or not the speech and debate clause would cover members of Congress and their staff with regard to employment actions. But this statute doesn't provide anything like that. And it doesn't also meet the paramount independent concern that's supposed to accompany an immunity defense or status, which is quite apart from not having to go through trial. Because the Supreme Court said in the Laurel Lyons case, everybody wants to avoid that. Could be a statute of limitations defense or a choice of law argument. It has to be some independent, overbearing, paramount interest that's independent from just saying, I don't want to go through the trial. Even if you have a statement that suggests that you're immune from standing trial, such as a head of state, because that would interfere with foreign policy or comedy, or the president, the Nixon case, because they have important executive duties to carry out. But this case doesn't provide that, and I don't think the statements, vague statements, that they want to adopt the kind of immunity provisions that provided in other state anti-SLAPP statutes suggest there's a textual basis that there is an immunity in this case. Moreover, there's a bit of a myth out there, which I think other circuits have failed to pick up on. The Ninth Circuit has found that you could have collateral order review from an order out of the in California, because California provides immediate appeals under their statute, as I know you know, Judge Brown, from your service on the Supreme Court there. But as you also know, in the Jarrow case that was decided in 2003, the California Supreme Court specifically ruled that that statute doesn't provide immunity. It's to weed out frivolous claims. And we cited this in our brief, and it was not replied at all in the reply brief. There was nothing addressed to it. But I think this is critical given the importance of this immunity issue that we're talking about. And in the Jarrow case...
May I ask you...
Yes.
If there is no appeal and the district judge got it wrong, that the SLAPP Act does apply, what is the consequence of that after final judgment?
I think the consequence would be that would be preserved for ultimate review. Just like, let's say the district court gets it wrong, that the statute of limitations does not bar an action. You go through a trial. You may win or not on the merits. But if this court on appeal concludes that it should have been dismissed because it was time barred, it would be reviewed then. I'm not aware of any court, Your Honor, that's decided.
One of the remedies, in addition to dismissal of the complaint, is attorney's fees and costs of litigation. How do you measure that on appeal when the district judge has denied the motion?
Well, I think you'd have to remand the case to say, if this court were to find 2 years from now that it should have been held to be retroactive and it does apply under Erie and it was timely filed, the motion, and it would have made a difference. You know, if they lose the case, you'd say you should have applied the anti-SLAPP statute, and if because we find
and not put the defendants through 2 years of discovery, but since they've already done it, do they get their attorney's fees and costs of litigation for all that discovery that has occurred?
I don't believe they would, because I think that would suggest that you're penalized then for a decision made by the court that doesn't apply, and I think that would be a tremendous penalty.
Isn't that one of the central purposes of the SLAPP Act is to?
Well, but every, you know, Your Honor, I understand, but like as you pointed out in the Sergeant of Arms case, everybody wants to forego the expense of a trial, and it may turn out later that they were right.
But the question isn't what plaintiffs want. The question here is what the D.C. Council was providing for media defendants and other people who are participating in public dialogue.
Well,
your position is they were not providing them any immunity from lawsuits.
Absolutely not. Okay. In fact, they use that word, but again, the Supreme Court's pretty clear you have to be careful about labels. And you can say that it's immunity, but is it really immunity? And if it is, if it truly is immunity, sometimes they said that's not enough under Will and other things, but piercing attorney-client privilege, or, you know, issues such as imposing discovery sanctions on the sergeant of arms, and you said that will have to await, in your decision, that will have to wait until the case comes back up. You know, you can always review. So with the issue of whether we're a cost, if there's a showing that there was some abuse by the plaintiff, I guess the court could address that even on appeal. But I think that would go back and say you should have held, and you need to now determine if there are appropriate costs.
But so to follow up on that,
yeah,
one of the reasons that people say this is like immunity is because immunity clearly is something that comes within the collateral order
yes.
doctrine, and so you can immediately appeal it. But even if you don't call this an immunity, don't you still have here a concern that an erroneous denial eviscerates a substantive protection of First Amendment rights? And isn't that itself significant enough to push this into the collateral order
doctrine? I, for the first person to say, of course, the First Amendment rights are extremely important. But I would also point out, having been in the library for 20 years, the Supreme Court's never held that a private citizen has an immunity to stand trial in a defamation case. And I don't know of any court of appeals that has. These statutes suggest that they'd like to do that. But I was just going to point out, in the Gerald case, the California Supreme Court said, with regard to this is the granddaddy anti-SLAPP statute that D.C. wished.
I'm not badgering you here. I hope I'm. You just said the statute suggests that they may want to do that. Isn't that the question here?
No. Well,
why isn't that the question for us? Is what the D.C. Council intended to create
because,
here?
Because I think let me get a card on that. That I think this court has held that you cannot create an immunity out of expressions in the legislative history. It has to be textual to start with.
But no, I wasn't referring to legislative history, but
well, it's not textual.
Yeah.
I mean, they could have said, we want to grant immunity, as they did in Nevada, and the Ninth Circuit said that's not enough because you said you wanted to provide immunity. It was actually in the text.
Well, it may not be enough, but it's also not required either. I mean,
I'm not prepared to say it wouldn't be required.
Okay.
No, I don't think you have to be required. But my point is that the statute they all point to in California has said the anti-SLAPP suit neither constitutes nor enables courts to affect any kind of immunity. This is the 2003 decision by the California Supreme Court. The Ninth Circuit, I think, has taken the fact that the California statute provides for immediate appeals and treated that as if it intended to create an immunity. I don't think, by the way, whatever a state court does for appellate review is binding or, frankly, even that relevant as to what a D.C. what a U.S. Court of Appeals would decide under Cohen. But there is case after case decided by the Supreme Court that says you may have lost your right not to go through a trial because we've made a decision. We're not going to review now whether or not you fit into the status of someone who is truly immune, such as a government official. That is part of the price of avoiding piecemeal appeals. You will never, I guess, be made whole from having to go through trial. But that is not the test because anybody could make that argument. Anybody will file a motion to dismiss under these anti-SLAPP statutes, make the exact same argument under anti-SLAPP, and will say I'm entitled to immediate review.
Well, your point is that for example, one could say that I have an immunity from having to defend a complaint that fails to state a cause of action.
Yes.
Right. And therefore, if my 12B6 motion is denied, I have an immediate appeal.
And that's exactly what happened here, because they didn't even repeat.
Which is not the law. Right.
No. And they didn't even repeat the 12B6 argument. They just incorporated by reference, word for word, failure to state a claim because it's non-actionable opinion, and said, as a matter of law, we can't be held liable, leaving aside. Now, we all know that would not be here today. We know that. Because they tried to certify that under 1292B. They abandoned that when they realized, let's bring that same argument up under this new statute.
1292B, but that deals with injunctions.
I thought A did, Your Honor. 1292A.
Okay.
I think B is a certification procedure for controlling issues of law that can materially
advance.
They
didn't seek a 54B certification.
They did not, Your Honor. They did not. And they did start, but my point is it's telling that with regard to the identical argument they suggest to you today is not on the merits. They made as a failure to state a claim. That's a defense. They haven't gained anything, by the way, with the statute.
Yeah, if 1292B is the controlling issue of law.
Correct. Yeah, that materially advances the, you know, right. As wishes there's support. They started that, and they said, you know what, we're going to get this. We're going to make the same argument, and we're going to say it's under the anti-SLAPP statute. We're going to claim that they actually have immunity. We're going to say it's retroactive and applies in Erie under diversity. I would point out, by the way, on that issue, I know the court asked a few questions under Erie. I'd like to point out that in the legislative history that's been talked about a lot, there's a letter from Peter Nichols, the Attorney General of D.C., at the time the bill was being considered. And he said to this critical issue of conflict, I fear this statute, sections 3 and 4, we're here under section 3, Your Honor, of the anti-SLAPP statute, which is motion to strike, or a special motion to dismiss, will abrogate rules 12 and 56 of the D.C. court system, which are verbatim to rules 12 and 56 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. So I would say at least the Attorney General at the time the act was being considered said, I think there's a conflict. He used the word abrogate. And he said, now his point, to be sure, was this may be a violation of the Home Rule Act. I'm worried about this conflict for that purposes. But it's difficult to say that there's no intent to conflict with rules 12 and 56 under civil procedure under the Shady Grove analysis. And as to your question, Judge Griffith, when you said, well, this labeling, you know, or procedural versus substantive, you'd still be able to raise it only if you satisfy that there's no conflict. I understand Shady Grove to say if you look at, you chart out the issue of what the rules provide for, and if they answer the question being posed, such as Rule 12 and 56, to avoid trial where there's not a meritorious claim, I think that is preempted. As Judge Wilkins said in the 3M case, and he went through great length to talk about the history of those rules. But importantly, he said, here's why I'm really troubled. This statute in D.C. tells me that after I have these facts that are brought in outside the complaint, and that happens here, they brought in numerous articles and statements from outside our complaint, and so that's part of the background for their anti-SLAPP motion. It has to be a Rule 56 motion. That's a must. In 12D, must be treated as summary judgment. When I get the summary judgment as a federal judge, here's what I do. I decide there's a genuine issue of material fact. If there isn't, I can grant summary judgment. If there is, I don't decide who's likely to win and dismiss the case. That's not federal practice. I have to grant a trial, and that's what this statute seeks to do. And I would point out that the Ninth Circuit did strike under California's anti-SLAPP statute the provision that limits discovery because it conflicts with Rule 56. And district court after district court, some of who have been reversed, have found that this trenches on their ability to conduct demurrer and Rule 56 procedures because it does interfere with when it has to be filed, what the burden is, what the pleading requirements are. You no longer make plausible allegations under Twombly. You have to show you're likely to prevail on the merits, a standard usually reserved for seeking injunctive relief preliminarily. So I would say there's a huge conflict under the Shady Grove. But getting back to the first question you asked, I don't see how the judge's order on March 15th could have extended a statutory deadline from a state that wasn't yet in effect. And if they would have simply disclosed, as we asked them to by letter, what motions do you intend to file, we would have been able to address that. We would never have consented to an extension of a statute that wasn't yet in effect.
Is that part of the record?
Yes. Well, we have indicated that we would have opposed it had we been told. And our letter asking for disclosure of the motions, I believe, is in the record.
But you consented anyway.
We consented because we were told that they were seeking an extension of time to move, answer, or otherwise plead. And as you pointed out, Your Honor, that's under Rule 6B. That doesn't mean that a federal judge granting extension under Rule 6B is extending statutory deadlines, which, by the way, are not in effect yet. I don't know how that could be. That means a federal court can decide that a statute may be passed a year from now, has been told, because he granted an extension under the rules. We certainly understood they could file a 12B6 or a 12C or some other preliminary motion envisioned by the federal rules, but not this. I also, in retroactivity, I would just point out that I don't think the ultra vires statement by Mr. Gandhi, a non-lawyer, non-council member, which is supposed to be addressing whether or not this was a fiscal impact, is the clear and unequivocal language that Your Honor pointed out is necessary under the BLM Judicial Watch case or Judge Kavanaugh's decision of March 20 of last year in the Metrol case that has to be present before you apply a statute retroactively. And that's not present at all. The D.C. Council saw his report and his offhand comment that this may or could benefit current and pending litigants. They could have adopted that. They didn't put it in the report. They said it does. We have the money. It was actually used for the purpose that we would expect the CFO to comment on. That's not the clear history that Judge Kavanaugh talks about or that the D.C. Court of Appeals talks about in the Bank of America Griffith case. It has to be clear and unequivocal. Doesn't have to be textual, but it has to be clear and unequivocal that they intend to apply it retroactively. And we know it's not purely procedural because
what's,
they are.
What's going on with this case now?
Well, we're up here, Your Honor. We were starting to seek discovery on whether or not we should substitute a party given the unfortunate and untimely death of Mr. Breitbart, and that was stayed because they asked you to stay any proceedings below. So we're awaiting that. And as we speak today, the defamatory blog, in our view, is still up on the website exactly as it was in 2010.
Has the complaint been answered?
It has been, Your Honor. It was answered before they decided to take this, I think, flawed interlocutory appeal under the anti-SLAPP statute. And again, I think it's very critical as to your jurisdiction. While the Ninth Circuit has said California seems to provide for this, and the Fifth Circuit said, you know, we'll take interlocutory review of orders under the Louisiana anti-SLAPP statute, they do that by looking at whether or not there's immediate appeal in the state court system. I don't know why that would satisfy this court's Cohen analysis. You know, that they can do that if they want, but tellingly, they overlook the fact, and it's not addressed in their reply brief, that the Supreme Court of California said this doesn't create immunity. This does not bar a plaintiff from litigating an action that arises out of the defendant's free speech or petitioning. That's the California Supreme Court talking about its statute, which, by the way, is a lot stronger than the one passed by the D.C. Council, which said we don't even have the authority to require immediate appeals because they think that would trench into the Home Rule Act and the scope of what the D.C. Court of Appeals would want to do. And it doesn't mention the word immunity in the statute like it did in Nevada, where the Ninth Circuit said it's not immediately appealable. And by the way, the Ninth Circuit in the Oregon case said, we will leave to a later date. They did deny appellate jurisdiction, Your Honor, and they said, we'll leave to a later date the Erie issues. They can come up later. We can decide that on appeal. So I think the issue, there's
the Ninth
no...
The Circuit seems to be in conflict with itself.
It does, Your Honor. Batzel is a hard case to square with the Supreme Court of California and Metabolic and Englert, the Oregon and Nevada cases that they've decided as well. But I think it's premised on a false understanding of California law. I still have 2 minutes, so I'm happy to have been jumping around on a lot of issues to cover in this case, Your Honor, but I did want to make sure I mentioned the policy issues, but there's no harm here. The argument they made under their anti-SLAPP statute, whether you find it applies retroactive, time-barred, it's just a 12B6 argument that they made that there's this non-actionable opinion, and I would submit, as Justice Rehnquist said, if you're saying you're exempt from defamation liability because you made an opinion or a comment about some other person's statement, but if you changed, edited, or corrected that person's statement to fit your interpretation, that's a factual matter. And Judge Niemeyer in the Fourth Circuit has said that. The Price versus Stossel case, Ninth Circuit, reversing dismissal under the California anti-SLAPP statute said, if you have a video that you've edited to create a false impression, in that case about a minister who said all the things about cars and fancy homes and so forth, they suggested through that video where they edited it that he thought that was a great thing. He went on to say, it's a terrible thing. That's not what life is about. That's not how I think I should conduct myself. Shirley Sherrod went on immediately after this tape was edited and said, I realized that was not the way I should treat these people. It happened 23 years, too, before the date they
said. She was a government official.
She was.
And
but
so
this occurred 20.
The case is squarely within New York Times versus Sullivan.
It is.
Which dealt with government officials.
Right? Yes. Yeah. It is, Your Honor. In terms of her capacity, but I would want to point out that the statement that she was talking about, that they said they just had an interpretation, it was just their supportable interpretation, occurred 23 years before as a private citizen when she was in Georgia. And they immediately corrected that. You don't correct opinion. And they edited the video on which they claim they're entitled to have a supportable interpretation. So that gets back to a jurisdiction, and I will leave off. This case couldn't be more clear. It's not collateral to the merits. It's reviewing the merits of whether or not you should follow Maldea in this case, which came up, by the way, from summary judgment from the court below. They just want you to give them an immediate review of whether or not they should have gotten out under a 12b6 argument, the one they incorporated by reference into the statute. That's all this case is, and I don't believe if that happens, everybody will be up here all the time under these anti-slap statutes saying, I was immune. I have an immunity. I want a review now that it fails to state a claim, it's time barred, they didn't plead actual malice with particularity. That's what this case is.
I just want to clarify one thing. I think that I understood you to argue that all of these slap statutes, which jurisdictions are enacting because they want to provide, they think, some substantive protection for people's right to speak freely on public issues, that your argument would be that simply can't be done because it would conflict with the 12, Rule 12 and 56.
Well, first of all, I think it could be done. I didn't mean to imply that. I think you could do it substantively, as Judge Wilkins said. If D.C. wants to pass a statute saying there'll be no punitive damages in a defamation action, such as we sought, because it's a matter of public debate interest, they could do that, and that would be presented under 12b-6. They could say there's not going to be any liability for intentional infliction of mental distress where you're involved with an issue of public concern. They could do that, and that would be presented as a defense. But they can't create a mechanism that directly displaces the demurrer practice and the Rule 56 practice and tell courts, here's what you're going to do if you find there's a genuine issue of material fact. You have to now predict, is he likely, or she, in this case, likely to win on the merits? And then you're going to dismiss it with prejudice, which is not required that a district court do. They can dismiss a case under 12B and say there's leave to amend, and you're going to award fees. You can't award fees. And in that regard, that's somewhat akin to the Alabama.
District courts are experienced in evaluating the likelihood of success on the merits. They do it all the time in preliminary injunction cases.
They do. I don't mean that they can't do it, but they don't do it when they're denying summary judgment. They say you get a trial. This cuts off our right to a trial because Judge Wilkins was concerned that I could be told under this statute, I'm looking at matters outside the complaint, and I have just some of the materials here, Your Honor, right, that were outside the complaint that were added in the motion. All these transcripts from TV shows talking about what happened with the Affordable Care Act, with Congressman Lewis, all this was brought in the record. It's clearly outside the complaint. When that happens, the rules say it must go to 56.
No, I'm not sure that's right.
Well, you could take judicial notice.
No. The rule is, what is it, 12D?
Yes.
Says that if a motion under 12B6 or a motion under 12H is filed and refers to matters outside the record, then it has to be dealt with under Rule 56. But this is not, and you said this earlier, this was not a motion under 12B6, and it certainly was not a motion under 12H. So 12D wouldn't apply.
Well, okay, they fought a motion identical to this under 12B6, and then they fought it under the anti-slap statute. And in doing that, they put into the record all kinds of things that were extraneous to our complaint. Now, the court could say, even take judicial notice. I'm satisfied with that. But when that happens, under the federal practice, that becomes a motion for summary judgment, and then the party is entitled to have discovery to answer that. As you know from the D.C. anti-slap statute, you may be entitled to discovery, but you have to make a specific showing. That's a huge change in how things are done in federal court, and I don't see how that's not a conflict. And it's not so intertwined with the substantive interest that Justice Stevens talked about in Shady Grove is to render it invalid. The federal rules invalid on the Rules Enabling Act because they can simply just give these provisions as substantive rights that can be raised as defenses under Rule 12, such as you can't bring this kind of an action in the district. So you can do that. Anyway, Your Honor, to your question, I'm not saying that these statutes don't promote important interests. I do think they violate Erie, and I think they can be presented as defenses, many of which were already adumbrated or anticipated by defenses that occurred over the years by the federal courts. Clear and convincing evidence, you know, actual malice, substantial truth. These are all defenses that could be raised.
We've taken you past your time. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Your Honors, first I wanted to point out that in the record at Joint Appendix 57, Judge Leon, in granting the order that ultimately extended our time to file our anti-slap motion on April 19th of 2011, was on an oral motion that was not under 6B, and I think that it goes to the inherent discretionary power that a court has to control its docket, particularly in a piece of legislation like this with its remedial purpose to protect speech.
That was the second motion.
That was the second motion, Your Honor, yes. It was the second motion.
If your time expired before that motion, then it couldn't have extended.
Although I think that the court does have discretionary power over its own docket to extend a time period like this where the D.C. Council did not make it jurisdictional. And I think that it's important to step back just for a second on the day before James Madison's birthday to look at some first principles here. Madison said the censorial power is in the people over the government, not in the government over the people. These slap statutes that are now in 30-some-odd jurisdictions around the country, each a little bit different. The laboratories of democracy under our federalism have created a number of different ways to protect and create these immunities. D.C. has some wrinkles that other states don't have. For example, that D.C. applies to current slap defendants. But the importance of these provisions cannot be underestimated because they ultimately fulfill the promise of New York Times versus Sullivan. When Justice Brennan said it would give undue preference for public servants if the people they serve do not have a fair equivalent of the immunity that public officials themselves have when they are sued for defamation. And what these statutes provide in granting those immunities is to enable a litigant, a defendant like Mr. O'Connor, to get here on appellate review and an interlocutory basis. And I did want to address Justice Randolph's point about the importance of being protected from discovery. There is no doubt that that is part of what these statutes are about. But another significant purpose of them is to grant the immunity to get interlocutory review because it is here in courts like this where First Amendment law is made. And for many, many decades, the people who specialize in libel law have collected statistics on what happens to judgments of lower courts when they come up to Court of Appeals. And the evidence has been in for a long time that it is in the Court of Appeals, ultimately, where First Amendment rights are protected. Some 70% of judgments in lower courts against the defendant are reversed on appeal under the actual malice rule in appellate courts. And that's why for a defendant like Mr. O'Connor, it's not just the protection from the discovery. It is also the ability to get here on interlocutory review. Finally, I did want to also make the point, Mr. Iannucci did get into the merits of the libel case a little bit. This post remains on the website of Big Government because to this day, they believe that their opinions about Mrs. Sherrod's statements to the NAACP are either true or supportable interpretations of what was in her speech. And what happened here is what happens in journalism every day. Mr. Breitbart had a source. The source saw the speech on television. The source was offended. The source provided Mr. Breitbart with some portions of the speech. Mr. Breitbart commented on those speeches. What he saw was Mrs. Sherrod saying that she did not give the full force of what she could do for someone who came to her in need simply because his skin color was white. She said it is ultimately about black and white, right? She said, I didn't give him the full force of what I could do. She also said that she ultimately did provide some help, and Mr. Breitbart noted that on his website. The speech became available 2 days later, and Mr. Breitbart saw further support for his interpretation that she was a public official who saw the world through a racial prism.
The protection, are you suggesting that the protection of New York Times versus Sullivan is limited to opinions? That the advertisement, in that case, Hedar Rising Voices, was contained false statements of fact.
And the protections of New York Times versus Sullivan, of course, go to false statements of fact.
Right.
And Mr. Breitbart and Mr. O'Connor could develop a record here that would explain the innocent mistake about the timing of when she first met that white farmer. And the importance of the mistake is that it doesn't change the commentary. The commentary is that it provided evidence of a public official denying a person assistance based on nothing but the person's skin color. And the law of this jurisdiction under Moldea is going to protect that statement. But the reason this is a slap case is because, just Judge Randolph, as you said, it is expensive to go through the burdens of discovery to make that factual record. And it's a slap case because she said, I want to shut down the Breitbart site. She says, I want to get back at him. That puts you in the realm of the slap statute. And when you have a pure question of law, such as opinion, that can be decided under collateral order, then you're in the universe of slap, because you can end the case quickly and expeditiously without needing to undertake the burdens of discovery.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
The case will be submitted.